Welcome to Beer Buzz. I'm Liz.
I'm Chris.
And today we're drinking with the legendary John Harris from Ecliptic Brewing. John, thanks so much for coming on the show today. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me. I finally made it. It's been like a year you've been trying to do this or something. So.
Tell me about the name Ecliptic. Where did it come from?
Okay, so I was decided back in 2012 to go ahead and quit my job and go open a brewery. So you got to have a name, right? So got to have a good name, you hope, right? Of course, I picked the name Ecliptic, which everybody wants to say Eclipse, or they want to say Epileptic or Eclepileptic or whatever. But anyhow, Ecliptic is, I'm an astronomy buff. It's a hobby of mine. And it's named after the ecliptic plane, which is the path all of the planets travel around the sun. All the planets kind of are on a level keel, as you could say, going around the sun. Like, one's not going like this, and one's not going like this. You know, so they kind of follow this ecliptic plane, and it kind of ties into my astronomy hobby, but also the fact that I really wanted to have a restaurant doing lots of seasonal food, and I wanted to have lots of seasonal specialty beers, and that all kind of ties into our trip around the sun on Spaceship Earth and cruising the plane. And now it's winter now. We want something hard and hearty and rich, and now it's summer, and we don't have anything to do with anything heavy. So, you know, everyone wants light beer, you know, right now. So,
tell us about what the craft brewing scene was like in Oregon in the 1980s. That's when you first got on the scene, right?
Yeah, I started brewing with the McMenamin Group in 1986. Prior to that, you know, this whole thing had started. I, you know, was in college, and this Red Hook beer showed up, and just like, it tasted like blueberries, you know? And at one point, Michael Jackson, the late great beer writer, is like, this has a Belgian character. So now, before I know that, it's a Belgian style beer, which is like, it was like ESB, called a Red Hook ESB. But anyhow, so I kind of like got in. This guy gave me a Dortmunder Action Brewery, a DAB German beer at one point, and a guy was older than me. And I'm like, wow, this beer has some flavor. Mm-hmm. What is this thing about other beers? So I started like getting into imports, and then the craft beer, like what we called microbrews back then,
right?
Started coming on the scene. So we had, you know, Pyramid out of Kalama, Washington, and we had Widmer and Bridgeport, and those were like the first three. Plus the out of, you know, Washington State, you had, well, Pyramid was from Washington, but Burt Grant's out of Yakima, and Red Hook out of Seattle. So those were kind of the first five, six breweries you started seeing around the bars in Portland. And they all were very unique beers and interesting beers. And it's like, oh, this is really cool. And I'd homebrewed like maybe five or six times, you know what I mean? I was really into that. I mean, but I was just totally fell in love with just all these crazy new flavors that were like, didn't remind me of the Schlitz or the Mickey's or the Budweiser or whatever happened to be cheapest that day at the corner store that you were drinking. So
so was your first real brewing job then with McMenamin's?
Yeah, so I...
Did you almost get fired on the first day?
Who told you that?
Everybody's got a great start.
So I applied to McMenamin's. It was an ad in the Willamette Week, said brewer wanted, and I had a housemate, and she's like, that's your job. You love beer. I'm like, I'm not a brewer. How are they going to hire me? So I roll in, and the guy's like, I go, I'm here to meet Conrad. And like, and I didn't know it was the same Conrad who I'd met like not 5 days before.
Yeah.
And he turns around, he's like, you want to be a brewer? I'm like, whoa, hey, yeah, I do. And so he's, you know, to ask me about what I know about beer. And back at that point, I mean, other than Carl Ockert, who was the brewer, head brewer at Bridgeport, even who had actually gone to college for winemaking and brewing, mm-hmm. I mean, no one else had any. I mean, we're all basically home brewers or mm-hmm. brewers that learn on the, you know, basically learn on the job, or, you know, like Kurt Widmer did this little stint over in Germany to learn how to make alt beer. So it was basically everybody's like, there was no experience, really. There's no experience. So at that point, you're not like trying to get a job with experience, you know. I don't have 2 years experience or whatever. But make a long story short, I got hired, and called him on the phone. He said, yes, you're hired. Show up. All you need to remember to bring is rubber boots. And I said, excellent. So at the end of my first day in work, he's, okay, John, I want you to get your rubber boots and climb into the kettle and scoop the hops out. And we had gloves, and there's still wort in the kettle, so it's basically just below boiling. And I'm like, rubber boots. Rubber boots. Hiking boots. I have my hiking boots in the car. So I decided to go into the car and get my hiking boots. And one of the hiking boots was that they were split. You can't see my shoe, but just the teal, the split. And the toe. I hop in.
Sanitation's kind of a big deal in brewing.
Well, no, this is not sanitation. I'm getting there to scoop out the hops. And the wort's gone. It's in the fermenter.
Okay. You
know, but long story short is that there was a gap between the sole and my toe. And right. Before I know it, that hot wort is now into my toe. And I'm like, oh, bring the ladder. Bring the ladder. Bring the ladder. He's like, what? Bring the ladder. I'm burning. So I climb out. He looks at me, shakes his head, and says, all right, you better have boots tomorrow or don't bother coming in. So immediately went, to the closest G.I. Joe's or whatever I could find. Yes. Bought a pair of rubber boots and all the rest is history.
To be fair, you paid the price.
Yes.
I just shook his head like, man. I mean, yeah, if I didn't show up with rubber boots the second day, this may not have happened. I may be making, selling cars for a living or something.
Yeah. Or very glad you're not.
Yes, very glad you are not.
And then from McMenamins, what was your next move?
Well, I was told my time at McMenamins, a guy came by with wanted to open a brewery in Bend, and I was like kind of helping him try to get some ideas together and getting him some numbers about like, you know, brewery design and layout. And at that point, remember, at this point, I'm coming on 2 years of experience in the beer industry. And back then, 2 years in the industry that pretty much got going in 82 or 80 with Sierra Nevada, then 82 with a couple of breweries in Seattle and Burt's Grants, and then 84 with Widmer and Bridgeport. This industry is like in 88. This is like, we're talking, you know,
you're already
5 years old. You know?
Yeah.
And so, so as Addison Brewer wanted to shoot brew pub Bend, Oregon. And, I saw that ad. It kind of glared at me, like they said, like the Grateful Dead talks about how they found their name, and like they opened up a dictionary, and the name just glared out of the dictionary. I mean, of course, I'm sure stuff was involved there, but anyhow, make a long story short, this did not happen to me in that case. But it was this ad, and it was kind of sitting there, and I was like, wow, that looks like a pretty cool job. But I was working with this other guy in Bend, Oregon, to open a brew pub. So it's like kind of like, and so, make a long story short, there's UC Davis, which has been the brewing school in America for years, and they had this kind of a 2-day program where you can go down, and one day is spent talking about the business of beer, and one side is talking about the brewing of beer. And so I mentioned to this guy, I said, hey, you know, it might be good, being that you really want to do this, to really go down and take this class and just see what you're all really getting into, you know, because mm-hmm. I didn't quite understand a lot of stuff. And so he decides to do that, and I go down with him. We decide just to make a road trip and check out breweries in California. And long story short, it was an ill-fated road trip. I realized that, you know, he wasn't, I don't know if I could really work with him, and he didn't necessarily have all the money that he said he had access to. So I came back from that road trip saying, I've been out of, because I gotten laid off for the McMenamins, and I got an injury, but anyway, long story, that's another story we really talk about right now. But long story short, I got back, and that ad kept popping up over the course of this month. This ad was still in the paper every month. You know, it's yeah. back in classified ads and papers mm-hmm. and stuff, you know? You won't understand that, a lot of you out there. But anyhow, so basically, I told this guy, I said, hey, you know, I need to find a job. If you want to make me an offer when you're ready to go, I will entertain your offer. But otherwise, I need to look for a job wherever I can get one.
Right.
Because I knew exactly what I was going to be doing. And yeah. I said, wherever I can get one, I made sure he understood that. And he's like, so he basically leaves my apartment. I pick up the phone, call down to Bend, Oregon, and Gary Fish and say, I'm your brewer. My name's John. I've been brewing for 2 years. He's like, when can you come down? So just a ghost of memory. But basically, I went down and interviewed and with him and his consultant he had hired. And, got the job, because back then he was really looking for somebody with experience. He wanted somebody who actually had made beer, not just like a student from UC Davis or something mm-hmm. who read about beer and learned about beer and was taught about beer but never had actually made it. So it was the first brewer at Deschutes down there in 88. So,
and I think that a lot of the beers that you brewed and your original recipes, the Mirapalm Pale Ale, the Blackbeard Porter, you know, some of those beers were the ones that really got people in my generation yeah. interested in drinking craft beer, because I was in high school when all of those beers started coming out. Uh-huh. And my father was adamant that I did not drink Schlitz.
Oh, really? Pretty cool.
So I remember I kind of didn't get in trouble for drinking as long as I drank
good beer.
Right. But I think, you know, for a lot of craft beer lovers, the Mirapalm Pale Ale was definitely the gateway into enjoying craft beer.
Oh, for
and
sure,
that's
yeah.
a recipe that you were responsible for originally at Deschutes.
Yeah, I made it for myself, and I just hoped other people would like it. And that's the truth. I had played with the beer at McMenamins with all Cascades, and back then Cascades was the most exciting hop you could get. Just, you know, now it's the smorgasbord of what's the cool hop. It changes every day. But Cascade is one of those ones that's kind of still classic, so classic. But it was just, and I wanted to implement this dry hopping step that wasn't done in the beer that I had made in you know, the prior brewery I worked at. McMenamins, we weren't dry hopping beer back then. So I really wanted to, and that was some new information that would be coming out about dry hopping, and not everybody really talked about it. You know, it's like, because all this stuff is like, we all kind of based all our brewing out of, based on England or German. Mm-hmm. And And the way we actually started making beers over here was, you know, totally different than the way they were making beers over there. And we're making it with American ingredients, trying to make an ESB with Cascades. It's like, it doesn't work. It's an American beer. That's what Sierra Nevada kind of proved with their pale ale, which is a Cascade hot beer, too. So, anyway, make a long story short, it's... So I kind of made this beer because it was a beer I had in my head for a long time. And then, you know, just people seem... You know, we started making it in the pub, and we had... original beers were Cascade Golden Ale, Blackbeard Porter, and Bachelor Bitter. And Gary was pretty much into those three beers. And whenever I put Mirror Pond on him, he's just gone. You know, like, and one of the guys said, you know, Mirror Pond sells way better than the Bachelor Bitter does. And Gary's like, no, we're stick to our core beers. So I'd make basically make Mirror Pond every other specialty beer. Mirror Pond would be back. And then once again, gone, you know, 20 kegs were gone. And so I shake my head again to Gary and go, yeah, you really be making this, you know. And then sure enough, once they actually, you know, eventually Bachelor kind of disappeared and Mirror Pond. It became what it was. Because it was a seasonal beer for Deschutes. Right. We'd bring it out, basically after Jubilee, we'd bring out Mirror Pond. It would be out for basically 9 months, and then it'd go away for 3 months, and we'd make Jubilee, and then back, you know, Mirror Pond would come back again, kind of like Oberon that Bell's makes. They'd only bring it out like 9 months a year, but it's the biggest selling beer in the whole brewery.
Yeah.
So right.
That's kind of where Deschutes was for a while, but then eventually after I'd left, they made it a bottled beer and year-round. So
tell us about the first IPA that you brewed.
Okay, yeah, IPA was a kind of a newer style that we started seeing at Great American Beer Festival in about 1989 when I first went, and it was like a lost style that, I mean, no one really had heard of and made. I think probably the most original IPA in America probably is Liberty Ale by Anchor Brewing, which is a dry-hopped, really light, you know, like very pale, it's not quite IPA strength, but I think it was the first one to incorporate the big dry-hopping step.
Yeah.
And then... followed by probably Sierra Nevada Celebration Ale, which is more of a red IPA. I don't want to say that because it might piss off Ken, but the point just is that, you know, it's very, very reddish-hued, but hopped like an IPA. So I think those two are kind of the predecessors to what has become IPA. But then at the GABF, I think that the first year they had an IPA category, it was like 7 entries. Now there's 370 entries, you know what I mean?
So, hardest one to win.
So but the first IPA that I made was with Full Sail, and we were asked to brew the commemoration beer, called Symposium Beer, for the Craft Brewers Conference, which was being held in 1993, if I remember right. And so we started cooking around the ideas at the brewery, and we all came up together as a group, kind of like, let's make this, it's the IPA's new, let's make one. We all, you know, because at that point, Golden Ale and Amber Ale were what Full Sail was known for, so very light, easy drinking beers, and make long, you know, I keep saying that. Start saying that. Make long,
yeah.
So we decided to make an IPA, and of course, we decided to take the English slant on it because at that point, so we were so enamored. A lot of brewers were so enamored with the history of brewing, and you know, at this point, it's like there is no history, and there's history, but it doesn't. Now it's all about doing whatever you want to do. Yeah. But so we got together some English malts and some pale malts. IPA is a golden colored beer, so it's still light colored. But then we got some, you know, UK Target and Challenger hops and some East Kent Goldings, which were the classic, you know, probably English IPA hop, and created this what would be very considered an English IPA.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the first real hoppy beer to come out of Full Sail, and we eventually kept making it in Portland on draft, and I was running the Portland brewery for Full Sail, so we're making lots of draft of this beer, and it kind of was one of the first IPAs on the market. And then later on at Full Sail, when I was doing their Brewmaster Reserve program, which was basically a program where I would basically come up with the program and brew the beers and then go out and talk about it with distributors, go see retailers and stuff. And in that series, I started making lots of different styles of IPA in the summertime. It was like I called the Sunspot series. So we had Sunspot, Son of Spot. We had the Grand Son of Spot. And then to top it all off, we had Prodigal Son, which the state of Utah did not like. And then we had the vast one I made was called Spotless. And that was the end of that series. But it was kind of a take on a certain style of IPA with these newer hops that were becoming available. So perhaps that's why, I mean, I was playing with IPAs pretty early on. And this would have been like in the, like I said, probably in the 90s, you know, mid-90s, late 90s.
And as far as accessibility to IPAs in the craft brewing scene in the Pacific Northwest, it was certainly your beers that everybody was drinking. And I think that's where the Godfather name came through.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the biggest IPA to take off in Oregon was Bridgeport IPA.
And of course.
That's really relaunched their brand.
Yes.
And then we had some others come through, like Terminal Gravity and then Ninkasi and then Boneyard, and so it's just been kind of, and now we're making Starburst here at Ecliptic.
Right.
Should we open a Starburst?
Let's do it.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how you feel that IPAs have changed in Portland over the last couple years, 5 years or so, they seem to be becoming more sessionable and less hoppy as people change a little
bit. Right. Yeah, so IPAs originally were like very much, a lot of people were taking English takes on them, and then suddenly these newer hops called Centennial showed up, and Chinook, and then eventually Columbus. And Columbus was like a game changer. It's like when we first smelled that hop, we're all like, we need to find a beer to put this in, because it had a little bit of rubber, which may sound weird, but and then it had like just fruit, tropical grapefruit and orange, and it was bred to be a high alpha hop for hop extract. It wasn't meant to be a flavoring hop in beer, but it just imparted such great flavor. And so some of these classic sea hops were what was driving the IPA market, and beers were basically golden to light orange, and they were hopped like an IPA, they were 65, 75 pushing IBUs at least. Mm-hmm. So they were very, the real upfront, and then the hop flavor, and not all of them necessarily in the beginning were dry hopped, which is very much a needed step in any IPA production. Now, yes. If you're not dry hopping your beer, you're not going to deliver the hop character that the IPA drinker is looking for. So if you're out there and you're not dry hopping your IPA, then we do make one IPA at Ecliptic that is not dry hop, but that's on purpose, and I'll talk about it later. But anyhow, nowadays, with the advent of the arrival of New Zealand hops and Australian hops, that brought this very unique character that wasn't citrus and it wasn't grapefruit or cat piss or tomato plant or any of those things that were like kind of a classic.
Punch you in the face.
Yeah, but in a good way. All these things were good. I mean, I know a story about an English brewer calling Cascades, it smells like cat piss, It's Cascades. And he smells like Chinook. He's going to be like, whoa, what happened? So just like, early craft brewing, or anything along the craft brewery line of what hops were available. At one point, clusters, early clusters and late clusters, that was hops in America. The ones that got picked early with a certain character and the ones that got picked late. Yep, we got two hops. Well, they're the same hop. Yep, we got two hops. So one of the biggest changes with hopping and IPAs, for instance, in the evolution of craft brewing, back then we called it microbrewing. I still like to say that because everybody thought we'd be less than zero, and we wouldn't make it. We'd be dead and out of business, and they were wrong. Anyhow, back to the story. So the biggest change was like when suddenly this Columbus hop I mentioned earlier came about. It was like so aromatic. It was like crazy, but it's like 17 alpha. So it's like what you started seeing is these what were bred to be either oil, hop extract, hop oil, or what we call bittering hops, because they were over like 8% alpha was considered high alpha. Then this was like 17. So we originally had low, medium, and high. But these high alpha hops, which, as you put into your whirlpool and you start extracting heat from it, you can start getting bitterness out of them. So where there's heat, there's bitterness. And so like we're trying to figure out how to use these hops for their aromatic properties, and eventually like over-bittering the beer. And we had to originally, start taking less hops in the boil to get that, we got the bitterness in the whirlpool and how we play with that. So for a while there, a lot of the brewers in America were using these newer hops to try to get different flavors in the beer, and that continues to this day where, you got at Full Sail, no, I can say Full Sail. That continues to this day where you have we make two different IPAs at Ecliptic right now. We have an Orbiter IPA, which is really based upon that classic old school sea hop, the old school Columbus, Centennial, Chinook, Cascade, Crystal, what have you. It's mostly all the sea hops and with some Simcoe. And it's more of an orange colored IPA, and it's more like, they call it classic style. And then we have this new one you're trying right now, Starburst, which is totally a modern style IPA. It's got, very light color. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bitterness is there, but it doesn't take your head off. It's really an IPA. It definitely tastes bitter enough, but it's not. But then the hop flavor is just juicy and creamy, yeah, and slightly tropical and citrus. And kind of that's what the market's kind of gone that way right now. So yeah, away from the classic sea hop IPAs to the Mosaic and the Simcoe with the Amarillo and the, we have Centennial in here too, which is still probably the most revolutionary hop actually ever created. But it can be used because it kind of goes both ways. So, so IPAs just kind of changed over time, and to a point now we have other, styles of IPA like West Coast IPA and New England style IPA. Yeah. And the New England's are like the big ones right now, and they really have no bitterness whatsoever. So I don't know how you can even call them a IPA, but we do, and that's okay because at this point, it's not so much tradition doesn't really matter anymore. You know, I mean, at one point, trying to get people to buy your beer in the old days, you had to hearken it back to something to get them to even try it. Well, right. This might remind you of like a Michelob because this golden ale is a little heavier than like the Budweiser you might enjoy also. It's like things like that, and now it's more like, oh, okay, we can throw that in the beer now. I mean, like McMinniman's was like one of the first fruit beer breweries in America was McMinniman's, and they actually got told by BATF then that they can no longer make fruit beer because it wasn't a legal ingredient in beer. So they had to petition them, and eventually became legal. So the fruit beers we were making early days at McMinniman's were actually, you know, the first ones in the country. And now you look at fruit and beer, and it started the raspberry trend of the 90s and 2000s, early 2000s, where everybody's just making a raspberry, light raspberry, taking like this style of like a chromosphere and putting raspberries in it, you know. Yeah. But now you see much more creativity with fruit and things like that. So like we have a peach sour ale that, you know, is made with peaches and also lactobacillus, which is we would never have put in any beer in the early days. That was like, oh my God, your beer's spoiled.
When you started your own brewery, did you have any wish to recreate some of these classic beers that you've been known for?
No, not at all.
Why?
Because I already did it.
Yeah.
If I'm already known for that, I mean, what have you learned? I mean, at this point, it's 31 years. When I opened the brewery, it was like 29 years or 28 years, whatever it was. But, yeah. I mean, you're kind of like, I've done that already, you know?
Right.
It's just like, I mean, don't you have another idea to go off that, on top of that? And that's just my way I think of it, because, like, you know, each piece is like, it's like a painting of sorts, you know? It's a different recipe. It's like a moment snapshot in time of that artist and what they were thinking that day. And, you know, Monet never did the same painting twice. I mean, it kind of looks somewhat the same, but they're always slightly different, you know? So you can make an IPA and change it a little bit and throw a little different hop in there, or even if you love it so much, you still can try to make it better. But I've never copied a recipe directly over at this point, whether I worked at McMinniman's or Full Sail or Deschutes. But every beer is influenced by every beer you ever made, so I've been influenced by lots of beers at this point. So. But back then, it was just kind of like what you knew, and like I said, that one hop that you found, like that Columbus hop, we need to get this in our beer somehow, and but it was so aggressive, it took a while to find a beer to put it in because, you know, you can just dream up a beer and just say, please drink this because it's going to be really different, you know?
Yeah.
Is there something particular that is, you know, on your mind right now when you're brewing? Are you doing anything particular or unique that you want to talk about?
Well, I mean, I started the brewery because I wanted to continue the creativity of, which is really kind of what's driven me this whole time for all these years, is that the ability to create and make beer. And every brewery I've worked for has put me in a position where I was able to do that. And like at Full Sail, I mean, I basically ran their branch in Portland, which was designed at a certain point, became just a specialty beer brewery. And my job was just to come up with new beers. And that was just awesome. I mean, I was there for almost 20 years. And so, or about 20 years. Right now, I mean, Full Sail kind of had their own kind of brewing style, which breweries that need to establish what they are, who they are, to, you know, and so I always had a lot of beers in my head, like especially the brewing with fruit back in the early days. I love brewing with fruit, you know, and something that Deschutes didn't do and Full Sail didn't do, and now they're both doing it now, which is kind of funny. But but things change, you know, times change, and so part of me wanted to get back to brewing, you know, with this, you know, brewing things I used to make, you know, or played with, and so I opened Ecliptic. The whole idea was there is no, we are not any particular brewery. We're not a fruit brewery. We're not a sour brewery. We're not a Belgian brewery. We're not a IPA brewery, you know, or whatever you want to say it is. I wanted it to be everything. I was trying to brew with fruit, make different things, come up with different ideas, just kind of have fun with it. And also, but also be realistic about like what people want to drink these days. And like, you know, if people want to be, you know, if they want a style like Chromosphere and you like making that style, well, make something that people want to drink. Because these days, people's tastes are changing so rapidly that, I mean, at this point, if it's got fruit in it, it's selling. Fruit IPA, you know, and we make lots of fruit. Like we have that year-round peach sour, which I know very few breweries that make that kind of beer year-round. So we're just trying to find our niche, but also, you know, have fun while we're at it. You know, I mean, like we decided to start canning beer back in March, and that's kind of changed our reality quite a bit to the point where it's like we're a brewery. We did 5,000 barrels last year, and we've already done 5,000 barrels this year.
And
we're on our way to 10 probably. So canning's definitely radically changed my life, and we're making a lot of IPA now. So, and a lot of the specialty products that I wanted to get out by now this year are kind of still lagging in the alleyways, saying, "When are you going to make me?" and I want to make these, but right now we're unfortunately, because we did decide to turn something on like that, we have to make as much of that as we can while we bring in more tanks and things like that.
And
react to the market.
So even though you had been brewing for 20 plus years, starting your own brewery is a totally different ballgame. And I'm sure you got advice from your colleagues. What was some of the best and worst advice you received?
Oh, I mean, just the general, you know, like things people say, like cash is king, you know, make sure you have good cash flow. And well, that's absolutely obvious, because if you don't have cash to pay your bills or pay your employees, you're not going to stay around for very long. So that was kind of, you know, it was great advice, but not very helpful advice, you know what I mean? One of the weirdest ones I got was from a, you can imagine someone in the industry say, don't give them too good of food. And I was I'm like, in my head, I'm like, well, that's the exact, that's what's friggin' missing in this food town of Portland, Oregon, is that people in a brew pub are not giving good food. You know, it's like, hey, honey, I want to go to over to, you know, Blah's Bar and brew pub and get a beer. That's fine. We'll get a beer there. Then I'm going to go somewhere else. We're going to get a cocktail. It's better food. You know, it's like, I hear this. Like, I hear it every day in the bars of Portland. I'm like, why in this food town? Why are people not eating in the brew pubs? Because they like food. So that advice was the best advice I was ever given to not follow.
Absolutely. And you do have wonderful food. And that is certainly the brew pub food became a derogatory term very early on. It was like, well, you know, it's pub grub. It's brew pub food.
So we got some wings, we got some nachos, right. You know.
So now you have to have a gastro pub.
We're not a gastro pub. We're just a very focused, clean menu with seasonal items and like, if you get, say, you quote unquote, we make world class beer, well, shouldn't your food be world class food? So,
absolutely.
So that was really, that was one of the funnier ones that was given, which actually was a great, great advice to not follow. Because I think we have actually now, coming on 4 years, have really shown that, as far as breweries go in town, some of the best food is being made. I'm not saying it's the best food, but I would say that. But in spite of what everybody else wants to be making, it's a focus. So we want to make better food there. And that's something it shows. So
who's your chef?
This guy came, Michael Molitor. He came from an Italian restaurant called Pazzo.
Okay.
He's done a good job for us, for sure. And he's challenged by a seasonal menu every 6 weeks, which is like it's quick to turn. And so he turns half the items normally every 6 weeks. And it's going well. But that was some good advice. The biggest advice was, you know, you have to have more than 100 seats. That's my friend Peter out of Utah. He's like, you got to have more than 100 seats. If you don't have more than 100 seats, you probably will not make it.
Wow.
And if you think about in Portland, there's a real, if you go in a lot of restaurants in Portland, you'll notice they're all like, not that they're not going to make it, of course, but the higher end restaurants are all like about 74 seats.
Mm-hmm.
That 75 seats, it triggers a whole other plethora of stuff. And so, but he's like, you got to have, when the bodies want to be in there, you got to have room for the bodies. When the bodies don't want to be there, you got to make sure you have it, you know, made where you can fill up one section and people will feel like, hey, this place is happening. Yeah. Like, we can fill our bar up. We have enough tables in our bar to make it happen, and then we can trickle into the dining room. Or when we, on a, you know, summer day, when we suddenly have, you know, all 140 seats inside and 120 seats outside full, we can, you know, accommodate everybody. Right. So
you have 240 seats?
Well, the outside patio.
Outside and inside.
Yeah.
Wow.
Doing that, actually.
So you doubled that advice.
Yeah. Well, no, but the patio's like, well, you got to remember, like the patio seat, okay, if you were to sit everybody, like put them all together, you could have about 130 seats out there, 128 seats, I think.
Yeah.
So that's where everybody wants to sit right now.
Right.
Yeah. Now then, I'll sit in the bar since the patio's full. So it'd be, you know, so we have part of our restaurant side, you know, during summertime, they're all outside.
Yeah.
You know, but at, like, our Mississippi Street Fair, you know, when we have 30,000 people come to Mississippi Avenue to celebrate the street party, you know, we can fill up the entire restaurant plus outside, and then everybody's just pulling their hair out because we're way too busy. But I'm just smiling. Like, he's smiling because we're making money, but he's not smiling for us, you know. So, but that was really good advice from him, was you got to have more than 100 seats. And actually, at this point, I that's what I would give someone else too. It's like, you know, make better food and don't make bad food, and have enough seats to be able to handle the volume when you need it, you know. And that's for sure, especially when we open, especially now on weekends and stuff. I mean, we're busy everywhere, you know, we're busy on the weekends and most nights. But the point just is that we have seats, like air conditioning. Suddenly it's like 100 degrees outside. Let's go place with air conditioning. Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, 140 air conditioned seats in our restaurant. So it's like, we can really accommodate to the people outside, people inside. So it's, you know, yes, don't underestimate the number of people you actually can draw to your place, because you know, if you have a good concept and make good product, then you should be able to draw people and be ready for them. That was the best advice I got, actually.
Do you have any funny stories that you like to recount about starting up Ecliptic or anything that's happened recently?
Funny stories. Thinking. Not a whole lot.
Silly stuff people did.
That's what I can't remember. I remember like going to my contractor, during the build out, and he said, "Okay, we're going to build this out in 60 days." And I'm like, "Okay, that's great. I've never heard of that happening before." And halfway, about 30 days into it, I go to him and I say, "So, hey Don, so where are we at?" He goes, "What are you talking about?" I was like, "No, I just want to check in about the timeline." And I told you 10 weeks, didn't I? And I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, 10 weeks.
10 more weeks.
No, 10 weeks. He's like, "No, October 16th or something, we'll be done." And it's like, "Oh crap, I think we best start hiring a staff." So I looked at my restaurant manager and said, "I think we need to start hiring because he's telling us
he's actually going to be on time."
Yeah. Yeah. And he did. He delivered the brewery 3 weeks before we opened, and the city gave us approval to brew or to occupy this. You got to get occupancy. So we got occupancy for the rest of the brewery side. So I started making beer about 3 weeks before we opened, and then on October 20th, about 4 days after he was done, we were late. We opened the doors and off we went. So then, as I always tell a lot of people, like they're getting ready to open a brewery, they go, "Yeah, getting ready for the real work to start, huh?"
Yeah.
Like, "What do you mean?" I'm like, "This is nothing, dude. You're trying to get open. Now you got to stay in business." Yeah. And those are two different things.
No, that's a good piece of advice. That is a good piece of advice. So what advice would you give to aspiring brewery owners and aspiring brewers to get into the industry now?
Well, those are two different things. Brewers, a lot of times these days it's right place, right time. It's putting your foot in the door. A lot of people are looking for experience. We've hired people with and without experience both. Continue your love of beer and knowledge of beer. And you got to get your first start somewhere. And that's sometimes that's hard, because when a brewery is looking for a brewer, normally it's because they're growing and they need someone to come on right now. But we've had brewers who had no experience to brewers with very little experience. So
I'm glad to hear that you've had people, that you've brought people on with no experience, because that's how you got in. And that's how this circle keeps perpetuating itself, and I'm really glad to hear that.
Yeah, but it's aspiring brewery.
How did they turn out?
Oh, good. Actually, one of the ones that had none is one of my best. Hardest working employees. He took a job as a host to get in the door.
Wow.
He wanted to be a brewer, and he took a job as a host. I won't say he hated it, but that's not why he was there. I had this open house. Before I opened, my branding firm thought it was absolutely insane that I would even try to do this. But I said, to announce the name of the brewery, I decided that I was going to have an open house, show the space, reveal the name, or the T-shirt, and offer some T-shirts for sale. Yeah. the first money. And I got 70 people show up to this thing. And I guess he was one of them. He just wandered through, and he's like, and he was a big beer fan, and he said he wanted to be part of it. So he just applied for whatever he could get. He got a host job, host food runner. But then when I needed help, every once in a while, I was like, I'd go grab Jameson. Say, "Come on back, help me." Ask the manager, "Can I have him for a half hour?" And yeah, so he kind of had been helping me. And so over time, it just became obvious that when there was a position available, that would be his, because he was such a strong worker. And it's like, we can teach you how to brew. We can teach, you already read about beer a lot. But anyhow, so I just think that, it's good to bring people in. And different roles, like our sales rep in Seattle, no experience, just was a beer tender, and we're like, "This energy was just great," and she's proven to be like just the best thing we could ever do. It's like she's just blowing doors off for us up in Seattle, and she's just awesome, but she had no experience. But someone had, like she said, "Someone's got to give me my first job."
Yeah. Well, so not only are you the godfather of IPA, but godfather to a lot of people's budding careers. Yeah. So cheers to that.
Yeah. You bet, yeah. Sorry. Not sure enough, have we? No.
John, after starting your own brewery, what is the best advice you could give to somebody who wants to start theirs?
Yeah, I did a talk last year at the Craft Risk Conference with another guy named Todd Knott, who, like me, decided to open a brewery basically late in their career. 20, over 20 years experience, decided I don't know why now, but you know, normally when you start thinking about when I can retire, you know, I'm like, I can retire in 10 years if I keep doing this, you know. It was like, and we gave a talk at the Craft Brewers Conference, and one of the biggest things that I may have said, and he actually echoed, was just like, you got to remember that you're not opening a brewery, you're opening a business, mm-hmm. And that's what you're really doing. You just happen to be in the brewery business, and if you kind of forget that, like, you know, like the one owner who just opened who said, you know, what do you mean the work just get, now the work starts? You know, he just didn't understand that. I look forward to, he opened a few months ago, I go look forward to calling him and asking him, you know, how is it now, buddy? Man, this is brutal, you know. So you got to keep in mind that you're starting a business. It just happens to be a brewery. And there's a lot of, you know, when you're just a beer aficionado, a beer lover, you're a lot of, you know, you're in rapture of the whole brewery. I want to have a brewery, you know, and that's great. But like for me, luckily, I had the experience in the industry to see all the sides of the business, to see, you know, the retail, actually working for the company to go out and sell our beer into the retail accounts, working with our distributors and how hard that can be and how easy that can be and how hard to get those relationships going is, and then the whole process of just, you know, staying in business, having cash flow to stay in business, and then the part of just like creating a quality product, because at the end of the day, the beer is just part of it. Then you got to brand it, you got to market it, and you got to sell it, and you gotta do it again. So it's just remember you're going into business. You're not just opening a brewery or a winery or cidery. It's like, unless you got deep pockets, you know, you there's a lot to learn, and a lot of people learn that pretty quickly, that it's not so easy out there. But I wish you all luck, you know, opening your businesses, because I think just like I did, I took a risk, and here we are almost 4 years later and things are going well. But so every day we still gotta sell beer and sell food and sell more beer and food the next day. So we have to bring people back and create our experience, and so that's really, really critical. But yeah, just don't think you're opening a brewery.
Live from NASA, what can we expect aside from a solar eclipse from Ecliptic Brewing in the next year?
Oh, I mean, like I said, this can line thing has been taught us that, you know, that there's a lot of demand for our beer, so we're really, I don't know, sort of struggling. We're just trying to ramp up our capacity, so we're hoping to be able to get more we're hoping to get more, you know, more cans available in the marketplace for everybody to enjoy. Still hoping to continue our specialty line of products with our different, like, say, fruit style beers and things like that, like our blackberry sour or our Belgian triple with black currants and things like that. We're going to do for our anniversary an Imperial Mango IPA this year, so that should be kind of fun.
Yeah,
we did a collab last year with another brewery, and that kind of is fed, like, okay, we did it once, which I thought that was awesome, but do it again, make some changes to it, you know, make it a little bit different. So I'm looking forward to that. You know, looking forward to, you know, like, you know, moving into our living in our fifth year, you know, and heading towards that big milestone of 5 years, which is, you know, still a year and a half, you know, a quarter away, but, you know, I'm hoping we'll get there, you know.
Yeah.
And just hopefully still create some new, interesting flavors every year, and still have a good experience in our restaurant, and just, like I said, Starburst was a brand new beer that we did draft only last year, and got a lot of people liked it a lot, and it's been doing really, really well right now for us. So look forward to sharing that with more people, and just kind of keep trying to grow, you know. It's been tough.
But fun.
More time off by John in the next year. That's what I know my family really like to see that. Wait, he's home. It's not 7:30. like I said, we have, you know, gosh, we almost have 50 employees, so hope, you know, continuing to provide a great work atmosphere and experience for the people who work with me, and they work for me, but would they really work with me to help create the Ecliptic experience. And I couldn't do it without, you know, everybody from the cooks in the kitchen to the servers to the brewers to packaging guys and, you know, salespeople. And the whole thing, it's like, built this huge thing. It's like crazy. It's like all these people rely on me to pay them every other week. Wow.
No pressure.
Well, thanks to all the people out there. We're in a really good spot right now. Ecliptic is. I think after almost 4 years, people are really kind of resonating with what we're doing. And it takes a while. It's just because you're brewed beer for countless 20 years doesn't mean that people are immediately just going to adopt your beer as being really good. But right now we're in a moment where people are really enjoying our beer. So I'm pretty stoked about that.
Great. John, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It has been an absolute honor and privilege to drink with the godfather of craft brewing for the Pacific Northwest. Thank you for paving the way for so many of us and sharing all your stories with us today. Cheers.
Yeah. Cheers, guys. Thank you.